and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on the program today. My guest is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. We'd love to have your questions for him during the next half an hour. You can call those in to 765-496-1999. You can email questions to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon. Good to talk to you as always.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here.
So I'd like to start out by talking about something that your city's Chamber of Commerce is doing. They're getting ready to open their own healthcare clinic. That's going to happen in December. I'd like to start by asking, you know, who's eligible for care at that? Is it only those people who work for chamber member businesses?
Yeah, that's my understanding. They've been working on this model for some time, and this is really kind of a spinoff from the clinic that the city, the county, and the school corporations operate. It's a similar model. It's not exactly the same. There's some key differences, but, you know, one of the things we had looked at in the business community, and we had had a lot of communication with the chamber about, was the fact that it's really difficult for small businesses to tackle the healthcare issue with their employees. And, you know, as we had worked through our clinic, this new model, which is called direct primary care, started to surface. And initially, the vendor had talked to the city and our partners about maybe combining it with our clinic. And that didn't make sense to us. It's a different business model. But I recognized that there was a lot of possibility there that could really do some good things for our small to medium-sized businesses in our community. I approached the chamber with that quite a while ago, and they've done their own homework and their own due diligence and put this model together in concert with this particular vendor. And it's taken a while to get here, but they're finally to the point they're enrolling people. But it's, you know, a business either pays into it or they payroll deduct and their employees pay into it. And you're exactly right. It's open to those businesses that are members of the chamber to enroll their employees. And basically what they're doing is they're purchasing health care at cost.
Does this speak to the fact that there might still be some unmet health care need in your community? Maybe people feel like they either need more services or they need just more access to those services? Or is it the kind of thing where maybe the businesses just wanted to have more perks that would allow them to attract different sorts of workers?
I think it's all of the above. You know, when we started our clinic, access was absolutely an issue, and we made that very clear. That has eased up some. I think access is better. More providers have been added to the community, but there's still an access issue. But at the end of the day, for these businesses, they are trying to find ways to, you know, address healthcare with their employees, but also to become competitive. And again, this comes back to workforce, which I spend a lot of time talking about. They're competing for workers. And if they can find a way that makes themselves more competitive in that marketplace, they're going to do that. And this is a tool that will really equip them to be more competitive. We've seen that with our clinic when we're recruiting public safety people or your city employees in general. The schools have definitely seen it. I've heard the superintendents talk about this being a significant recruiting tool with new teachers to be able to offer something like this. So it's kind of a combination of all those things. But, you know, in reality, in the end, you know, healthcare costs can just spiral out of control. And as an employer, you've got to find ways to start addressing that.
Is this designed as a supplement to the care that might be provided under traditional health insurance that a company might offer its employees? Or is this, you know, an add-on to coverage? Or is it completely separate where you could maybe have this as an option where, and you wouldn't have to pay what have been hugely escalating health insurance costs for some employers in recent years?
Well, this isn't insurance and it doesn't replace their health insurance. But what it is capable of doing is taking employees who are in the high deductible situation and give them a realistic opportunity to buy their routine care at a much lower rate. So if they are in that high deductible category, and many employees are, now they're getting that routine care, but it's not designed to really replace the insurance as far as, you know, if you're hospitalized and more significant, you know, events like that. But the routine things, the physicals, the routine care, you know, the you know, somebody's ill, those kind of things, you know, it certainly covers those things. And this particular model is based on primary care, what we've really noticed with ours is that you create an environment that is more user-friendly than the traditional model, and people are much more likely to engage in that system and engage in preventative care. So we literally saw some of our employees who had been on medications for years come off those medications because they'll go in and meet, you know, once it's user-friendly. So they'll go in once a week and meet with the nurse practitioner, let's say, and you know, they'll coach them through changes that they need to make, and it's had an impact. So it's a really good move, and it's a really good move for those small to medium-sized businesses. And I know the business community here has been kind of anxious for this to take off for a while, and there's been some delays and some bumps in the road, but they're finally there with it.
So it sounds like you're saying that you were seeing potentially some barriers to people seeking care that they might otherwise have sought, and you're trying to sort of bring those down.
That's one piece of this for sure. Absolutely. If you think about the traditional model, and at the time we started our clinic, you know, if you're going to call and get in, you couldn't get in today or tomorrow. It might be next week or the following week. Then you've got a copay, and you've got, you know, you show up and you're in the waiting room for half an hour, 45 minutes, and then you can see. I mean, there were just so many things in the way that discouraged people. Unless they really, really needed to go, they weren't going to just go to get their blood sugar checked and make sure they were on track. That was not going to happen. But, you know, the model that we utilize, they can get in very quickly. There's an absolute focus on making sure they're not there very long. They're not in the waiting room. You know, they're in and out, and they can go on with their lives, and it works.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA, chatting today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Send us your questions via email to ask@wbaa.org. Call them in to 765-496-1999 or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, we received an email this week, and you were copied on the same note from Victoria Hudson Swisher, who's a member of the Crawfordsville Human Rights Commission. And I'd like to start, if I could, by giving the listeners just a sense of what that said. And I'd like to read a short piece or two of the note. So here for the listeners is what it says in part. Victoria writes, "The lack of transparency on the frequent cancellation of the HRC meetings is not what I had in mind when I met with Mayor Barton and with Del Wilson about forming the HRC. I have promoted the HRC at events and listened to those who disparage the HRC as do-nothings, an insult to those of us who do care and support HRC activities." She goes on to say, "I was asked to submit some names of members of minority communities, but when I did physically bring someone in who expressed an interest, no contact was taken. I will be submitting my resignation at the next meeting." So there's a lot to unpack here, and I want to sort of take this point by point with you if I can.
Sure.
First, let's talk about the cancellation of meetings. This is something you and I have talked about kind of from a 30,000-foot view on this program in the past. This is not uncommon for city meetings and indeed county meetings in Crawfordsville and Montgomery County to be canceled for lack of an agenda, lack of something to do at a meeting. I was looking at the city's website. There's just one Human Rights Commission agenda for this year. No minutes have been posted for any meetings this year. So let me ask you, is the Human Rights Commission falling back possibly into the disuse that caused it to disband many years before?
Well, I think that's a real threat. And, you know, I think where we're at right now is, you know, I have several thoughts there, but we're probably at the point we're going to have to step back and rethink this a little bit, and maybe, you know, try to think through our approach a little differently. But, you know, what's coming to play here is this particular meeting was canceled due to a lack of quorum. And, you know, it wasn't a lack of an agenda. It wasn't a lack of an initiative on the city side. We just literally could not get the members who serve on that commission to commit to coming to a meeting. And, you know, if you think back several months ago, and I don't remember exactly what month it was, I appeared before the Human Rights Commission and talked about the ICE raid in a local restaurant. And you know, the commission had lots of very good questions. But my concern was, at the end of the day, they had questions and they thought, you know, maybe there was some things they needed to do. And I agree. And then they turned right around and decided to recess for the entire summer. And this, I think, probably would have been, you know, their return from that long recess. And then you can't get commitments for people to actually come to the meeting. So, you know, I understand her frustration with that. But at the end of the day, these are citizen volunteers, and we can't drag them in here if they don't commit to coming to the meeting. I think what you see with the lack of attendance, there's several things going on there. One, I do know some of the members currently are dealing with health issues, so we kind of need to work around that. But I think a little bit of it too is just the sense that maybe this commission has not really found their legs. They've not found their way yet, and I talked about that at length when we brought this group back. We resurrected this group. That it was going to take them some time to really find their way, and they're not there yet, obviously, and they're struggling with that. And it's a tough call for me as mayor because I certainly could be at every meeting and dominate the discussion and lead the discussion, and I've tried very hard not to do that. I want to equip them, empower them, and then kind of stay out of the way and let them. I don't want to see this as an extension of the mayor. I want to see this doing its own work. And, maybe I've been a little too hands off. They've not really picked it up and ran with it like I hoped they would. So, the other piece that comes into play, this is a very diverse group by design. And, so you have a lot of different people from different backgrounds who have totally different views about how they should approach, a lot of different things, including a meeting, and we see that play out. I mean, this is a group that, it's not filled with people who all think and act the same way. So it becomes very challenging to kind of get them all on the same page, if you will, to move forward with these meetings. But I understand her frustration. I absolutely do. But several we just could not get a commitment. And several of the seats are up at the end of this year, so I'm certainly going to step back and look at those appointments. And I've asked staff to compile attendance lists for me so I can see who's attending and who's not. I've been to some of the meetings, not all of them. So we're going to take that into consideration. And when we first talked about this and we first put this out to the public, I had twice as many people interested as I had spots to fill. So I know there's an interest. Unfortunately, some of the people we've put on just are not attending for various reasons.
And we should point out to people that all 12 members of the commission are appointed by the mayor, and so you have quite a hand in that. Victoria talks in her letter about the issue of trying to get more people of color on the commission. You and I have addressed that on this program, and that was initially a problem that you had, was you didn't feel like you had enough diversity of membership. She's saying, look, we're bringing people in to physically meet with the commission who would meet those qualifications, and nothing is being done. How do you address that?
I don't think that's entirely accurate. I think I know what she's referring to, and I've put the call out and said, hey, if you know people who are interested, by all means refer them to me. I would love to meet with them, see if they're, see if I can get them engaged and get them involved. She has referred some people to me, but they don't meet the qualifications. And the primary driving qualification is they have to be a resident of the city of Crawfordsville, period. There's just no way around that. And every referral she's given me, I've not been able. They're not city residents. I mean, they have some ties here, and maybe they work here or something like that. But they're not city residents. So I would love to include them, and I encourage them to come to the meetings. But I can't appoint them to the board unless they meet the qualifications. So I'm still openly, actively seeking people and more diversity in that group. And there, we've had one opening for a while that I've intentionally not filled because I want more diversity. And I have people interested, but they don't give me that diversity. So, certainly open to it, but I don't think she's always understanding that they have to meet the qualifications. I can't just put somebody from somewhere else on this commission.
You have spent a fair amount of time, of course, reconstituting this board and finding members for it. It's obviously important to you. Now that it seems in a little bit of confusion or disarray, you talked a second ago about needing to be more directly involved. How do you go about doing that when, as you also said, you didn't want this to be an arm of the mayor necessarily? You wanted it to be a self-functioning board. How do you make that distinction? How do you draw a line there between getting too involved and not being involved enough, as seems to be the question at the moment?
The email the other night, caused me to kind of pause and think about this a little. And, this has certainly been on my radar screen for a while. My thought right now, and we're still kind of early in this, is that I will be meeting with as many of those members as I can to kind of talk through what's working, why are they kind of struggling. The gentleman who currently serves as the chair of this group has made it very clear that he does not want to continue in that role. So there will be new leadership, and I think he's done a great job. I'm not saying that at all, but you know, it could be a change in direction there. Somebody with a different focus or different, you know, thought process of how they move forward. So I'll just be meeting with them. You know, I think there's some key people in there that really have some leadership ability if they choose to step up and do it. So I need to talk through what it really takes for them to step up and do so. And maybe it's that they don't feel, you know, that they really clearly understand their role and their mission. And if that's the case, then we need to try to flesh that a little further out. But I'm confident we'll get there with it. We just are going to have to step back and kind of rethink it a little bit.
The letter seems to say that responses that the community has given indicate to at least Victoria that sometimes the HRC has not been taken perhaps as seriously as it might be taken. So is there a way for you, as you go about this rethinking process, to maybe imbue it with more power or importance or teeth or what have you, to try to get people to take it more seriously, so that it is not just something that the community respects, but it is indeed seen as so important that people from different walks of life want to give their time to it, want to make sure that they make the meetings, etc.
That has to be part of the overall discussion with those members. And I need to get a clear sense from the other members if they feel that way or if that's what they're hearing. That doesn't match what I hear from the public by any means. In fact, I hear the opposite. So is her take on that just an outlier, or is that kind of the norm? And you know, let's assess that and find out where we're at. And if that is more of a commonly held belief, then let's talk about what we need to do to change that perception, and go from there.
We've got about 10 minutes left with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton on today's Ask the Mayor program here on WBAA. You can email questions to ask@wbaa.org or call them in to 765-496-1999. We've also been reporting on a case that your city's police department was called in on. This is an alleged rape in April by a Wabash College student of a young woman from another school who had gone there for a party. How much are you keeping up with this case in which a lawsuit has been filed that names the student, the university, the city, and others?
Well, the city's not named in the lawsuit. So, I mean, we are named in one of the allegations, but we're not a party to the lawsuit. So, you know, we're monitoring it, and we're monitoring it very closely for several different reasons. My concern here, and I mean, number one, we have a court system in place. We need to respect that. We need to let the due process run its course and let this play out and stay out of the way of that. But number two, there's a very specific allegation made in this lawsuit about the detective, the Carversville Police Department detective in this instance, that I just find absolutely shocking. And I've said before, and I'll say it again, I have the utmost confidence in our officers and what they do. And in this particular case, and in almost every case, and I've said this on this show over and over, this interaction between this officer and this young lady was recorded. So there is an actual video recording of this interaction. So I'm shocked that this allegation would be made in this lawsuit when the attorney making the allegation had never viewed the tape, had never seen the tape. I've not personally watched the tape, but I've been briefed on what it contains. And the allegation that's made is just absolutely not true.
Let's talk about the tape a little bit, because you did an interview immediately after this came to light with our reporter Emily Seiberg, in which you said your police department would happily release a video of that interview. Obviously, we understand that in some cases these things need to be scrubbed of some personal identifying information or things like that. Do you have any sense of when that might happen? We, a week ago, filed a public records request with your police department, haven't heard anything back on it. We were just trying to figure out when that might be available so that, as you say, it can be scrutinized.
Right. Yeah, my understanding is, you know, a week ago when those re and we had several requests at the same time, my understanding at that time was that it would be 1.5 to 2 weeks from that point we would have it ready. And what we're doing there is, because this particular lawsuit involves alleged sexual assault, It also involves the plaintiff in this case remained anonymous. We need to make sure that we protect those pieces. So, in the beginning of this tape, there's very personal identifying information such as name, date of birth, social security number. We need to get that removed from the tape before releasing it to the public. We're also blurring the face of this young lady because of the nature of the lawsuit. So we're in the process of doing those things. It's been through the legal review, and it's in the hands of basically the IT people now who are implementing what legal has told us we should do with the tape. So, at this point, you should see it, I would say, probably in the next week.
The allegation that's made in the tape that you referred to a moment ago is that Detective Long advised the woman that there was a close relationship between the police and the school, and that Wabash's gentleman's rule was also in place, which affected some of the discipline that is handed down in some cases at the university, and that perhaps the suggestion was that she was not likely to see that the student disciplined harshly if it was in fact found that he had done something wrong. What sort of training, I wanted to ask you, is given to officers about how to interact with the college, how to talk about its practices? We should say here, just for the sake of complete openness, you yourself are a Wabash College graduate, obviously have a very close relationship with the school still as mayor of the city. But what sorts of discussions are had about the different rules in place on campus versus the law of the city itself?
I don't know that there's any specific, training that just equips them to understand the rules of Wabash College, because that's really, in this kind of instance, that's irrelevant. Our police officers are there to enforce the laws, and that's what they're going to do. And, so whether or not they would be speaking about the gentleman's rule and how that applies to this kind of thing, I don't see that. There's not training involved in that. What they're going to do is apply the laws of the state of Indiana, period. And I am, like I said, I have the utmost confidence that when people see this tape, and it's, in a sense, it's kind of unfortunate this has to be put out there because this is something that's very personal and sensitive to everyone involved. But, it's public records, and when a claim is made like this, then we have an obligation to put that out there. But I'm absolutely confident that what people are going to see is not the way it was portrayed.
What can you tell us about the investigation of the allegations? We've not been able to find anything and haven't heard anything about potential charges against the student involved, or even indeed whether the allegations have been fully investigated. What do you know about that part of the case?
Well, the Crawfordsville Police Department did complete their investigation some time ago, and I don't know the exact date. All of that information was forwarded to the prosecuting attorney in Montgomery County. Ultimately, it would be their decision whether or not they file criminal charges. So our investigation is complete. It's in the hands of the prosecutor, and I have no idea. I know charges have not been filed, and I have no idea if their review is complete or not. So it's again in the hands of the prosecuting attorney, not something that's being held up on the police department side. Our investigation is complete.
In a case like this, is there any sort of recommendation that is attached to the police department's investigation to say we believe that there is probable cause or we believe there is not probable cause to file charges?
I don't believe so. I think that what you see in a case like this is you see, the detectives and the police reports provide as much background and, the interviews and all the facts and information that they can gather. And then it goes to that prosecuting attorney to make a decision of whether or not they think this is a case that warrants criminal prosecution. So that call is going to be totally up to the prosecuting attorney.
Let's talk about the Wabash College gentleman's rule for a second. This is a fairly broadly written document. It's only a couple of sentences long. I mean, one paragraph just saying that it is assumed that any Wabash College student will behave himself like a gentleman. You did an interview with Emily Seiberg saying you thought that that was much more comprehensive than the law would be, that it is a higher standard. But is it possible that the school needs to look at its policy because it is, in fact, very broad? It does not outline specific cases of behavior or specific punishments for violations of specific behaviors. Does it need to get more specific?
I think that's an ongoing debate, within the Wabash community, and I'm sure it's a debate that will play out. And instances like this cause us to stop and think about that a little more. But I'll stand by what I said earlier. If everyone in society lived by the gentleman's rule or the lady's rule, we wouldn't have crime. That is a much higher standard. And certainly if you're behaving as a gentleman, sexual assault is not even going to be an issue. So whether or not this student violated the gentleman's rule, none of us know. Perhaps he did, perhaps he didn't. We don't know that, but that is a much, much higher standard. So I guess my point is, people shouldn't be taking away that, well, they're skirting the law by falling under this gentleman's rule. That is a much tougher standard to comply with. If every citizen in Carversville was a gentleman, a lady, and a gentleman, this would be a very peaceful, easygoing place, and that's not the case. So, the distinction between a gentleman's rule and the law, to me, is pretty far. I mean, it's a much tougher standard, much tougher standard.
Do you think the community and or the campus should perhaps have a public conversation about this?
I think that's a conversation that Wabash has to have amongst themselves. And at the end of the day, I think there are a lot of things at play right now. A lot of things we've seen some a lot of questions with Wabash about the elimination of the sheepskin diplomas and things like that. And for me, at the end of the day, it's really comes down to the college asking themselves if they're being true to themselves and their own values. That's what it comes down to. You're talking about an institution that prides itself on teaching people how to think critically, teaching people how to solve problems, live humanely, those types of things. And when you move through a process like this, it's fair to ask whether we're living up to those things. And I think that's something that the college themselves internally will have to work through and discuss. As far as the community, we're certainly open to having that kind of discussion. And believe me, we take any feedback we can get about the relationship between, the town and gown relationship, which by all accounts right now has improved dramatically. So we don't see problems there, but if we do, we certainly want to know about it so we can get out ahead of it.
I was going to ask about the town and gown thing. What are you hearing from residents who maybe are not connected to the school about this case as it's been in the media?
Zero. I've not had a single resident approach me and discuss this. I mean, I what I hear is, from the lawsuit side and then from the, from the Wabash side a little bit, but this has not really been a big topic, which I guess maybe is kind of surprising, but I just don't hear much about it.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, the show went quick, but that's all
Thank
we've got
you.
time for. Thanks so much for your time. We'll do it again next month.
Thank you.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember that next week is our fifth Thursday of the month, so we will be taking a break. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our conversation with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. Send your questions for him or for any of our other mayors to our email address, ask@wbaa.org, and we'll get to those at the top of the next program with the appropriate person. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.